Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. From Columbia University comes a study about how high serum magnesium level is associated with a lower risk of cognitive impairment. Now that's very important considering how many millions of people suffering from some form of cognitive decline that frequently leads into dementia, and it doesn't take long. Depending upon your lifestyle, what you do or don't do, you could go from cognitive decline to dementia in 2 or 3 years. And once you're there, it's really, really tough. Give you just one example of this. How many times have you forgotten things and then you find them? But you're sure someone took them, but they didn't. And then you're sure that you took your supplements, but you didn't. Short-term memory goes. Long-term memory can be very acute. You can remember things from childhood with accuracy. A friend of mine, a longtime friend, since I came to New York City, and over those years had thousands of get-togethers, parties and dinners, just sitting, talking, going for walks and discussing art. He's a very famous artist. And every day, for years and years, decades, he would stop off either at 84th Street, when I was over in that brownstone near Riverside Drive, and we'd talk exactly at 10 o'clock, then down at 72nd Street, and then up at 83rd Street. So you're talking about a long period of time. And then one day, he started to say this, do you want to get together and have a bite to eat later? Sure, no problem. We'll have some lunch after your show. Okay, a little restaurant is closed now called Mana. It was there for like 30 years up on Amsterdam. Small little restaurant, nice macrobiotic restaurant. And then one day, and I'll never forget this, it was like we finished lunch at 2, and then I see him walking down Broadway around 7 o'clock at night, and he stops and says, hey, Gary, want to go have a bite to eat? And I said, we had lunch to eat. No, we didn't. Yeah, we just had lunch 5 hours ago. And he said, really? And then it begins, and then it gets worse. Until, Gary, can you give me a protocol? Sure. Yeah, I'll create a protocol. Give you the protocol the next day. Gary, could you give me a protocol? Yeah. For 3 months, every single day, he forgot that I'd given him a protocol. He wasn't using the protocol. And then it takes another big slip down. So this is what happens. It's horrifying to see. You feel sad. Now, depending upon whether a person's able to do something or needs a support system to do it, that's why we should at this time realize the vast majority of Americans do not have a health support system. They don't have people who are competent, able, and qualified to help them through whatever they are traversing at this moment. And as a result, frequently they're on their own. I just saw a report last night from some doctors in different hospitals, not in New York, but around the country in small communities. They're seeing more suicides than ever in their history. As one doctor said, we just had more suicides in the last month than we would normally have in a year. So when people don't have a good support system and they are suffering physically, mentally, then they're likely to get into harm's way. They're more susceptible to heart attacks, strokes, cancer, and if you're older, dementia. And that's because of a hormone known, and by the way, everyone should be aware of this hormone, cortisol. A friend of mine called me and said, I'm desperate. I said, what's wrong? He said, I'm losing my hair. I mean, lots of my hair. I said, well, it's normal to lose between 50 to 100 hairs per day. That's completely normal. The cycles, the hair stop and start in different parts of the head. And he said, no, Gary, no matter where I brush and after I shampoo, there's a wad of hair. Okay, what's changed? Nothing's changed. Well, something's changed. I don't know what's changed. Nothing. My diet's the same. Now, stop and think, and you call me back, when you realize something has changed, that's the catalyst. So later that night, I get a call. Yeah, I've been dealing with a lot of personal stress for the last 2 months. Now, when you say a lot of stress, I mean everyday stress. It's with me all day long. And he talked about the stress. And he said he feels kind of helpless, and the relationship ended, and he feels alone, and he's confused, and he didn't know why it ended. And I said, okay, do you realize what cortisol will do when you keep it elevated? You'll lose your hair. You'll get funguses. If you're a woman, suddenly you're more susceptible to fungus, vaginal funguses, yeast and candida in your body. It's just not sugar. It's just not fermented foods. It's just not mushrooms that cause this. And it's cortisol. People just don't understand. When you're stressed, you're doing an enormous amount of damage to your body. How it manifests, it is determined by each person's biochemistry and emotional makeup. In any case, so when you can take something as simple and inexpensive as magnesium, and let's say you double up, you normally take 400 milligrams, but now you're taking 1,000, which would be what I would recommend, and you're doing something to alleviate your stress, then your concentration, your ability to be more cognitive, walking into a room and know why you're there, what you're doing, remembering what you just read last night, remembering the high points of the music you listened to, or the movie you saw, or conversation you had, that's cognition. So this study showed that when you have more magnesium, that is in place, and that can help prevent a lot of conditions. This was about stroke also. This was the National Institute of Neurology Disorders and Stroke, and the National Institute of Health did this study. So get yourself relaxed, engage in some form of constructive cognitive improvement exercises. The Max Planck, a very respected institute for demographic research in Germany, found that being generous allows you to live longer. It's that simple. The act of giving and receiving increases well-being. The recipient benefits directly from the gift, and the giver benefits indirectly through emotional satisfaction. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal, PNAS, and that shows that those who give to others live longer. So that just makes sense. That's something our grandparents would have told us, right? And we just forgot about it. So, and they found that people in sub-Saharan Africa, countries like Senegal, share the lowest percentage of their lifetime income and had the highest death rate for all the countries studied. And those who share little die earlier. And then it shows those who share the most in their life, even if they don't have any, live longer. Interesting. It was about, I'm guessing, 2 years ago, more or less, I watched a video of two guys wanting to see what a homeless person would do if they gave him $100. So they walked by the guy and dropped some money. Well, first of all, the guy picked up the money and ran over and gave it back to him. That's good. That shows character and ethics. Now, mind you, the guy's homeless. He's on the street. He could have used the money. So then the person says, no, you keep it. You keep it. And the guy said, you sure? Really? Yeah, keep it. They went across the street and they were in a van. They were filming this. Now, guess what the guy did? There was a store that he was sitting beside, and you see the big sign, liquor. So he goes in this store that had the sign liquor, and he comes out with a shopping cart, and he goes across the street to where there's a park, and he starts handing bags to all these other homeless people, because not only did they have liquor, but they had food. So he bought food, and he shared it. Think of that. As long as we have people who are that selfless, think of the joy they bring. And yet we have people who have everything in the world, especially our professional class and the millionaire class, and they pride themselves on what they can buy and how expensive a rental they have in the Hamptons or what yacht they get invited to. When was the last time they went out to find homeless people to help? That tells us a lot about our problems today. It also tells you that no matter how down you are, you've lost nothing that's essential to who you are. Keep that in mind. So just remember, when you can give a gift of laughter, a gift of health, a gift of support, you're going to live a longer life. Also, from the Karolinska Institute, a very good institute in Sweden, published an article in the Journal of American Society of Nephrology, simple lifestyle choices can reduce the risk of chronic kidney disease. And there's a lot of people who have kidney disease who've died as a direct result of having that. Simple things: get off the sugar, get off a meat-based diet, start to exercise, don't drink soft drinks, don't drink caffeinated beverages, drink healthy water, no alcohol or smoking, plant-based diet, exercise, get off alcohol and drugs, and you're protecting your kidneys. It's that simple. Also, there is a berry, it's called choke, C-H-O-K-E, berry. And it improves cognitive performance, mood, and vascular function. This is according to Maastricht University in the Netherlands. So it's loaded. It's a little orange, kind of crunchy. It lasts a long time in the refrigerator, and you can get them dried and a little tart. They're extremely rich in anthocyanins. Antho, A-N-T-H-O, Psi, S-Y, anins, A-N-I-N-S. And that's especially good for everyone. Also, there is what is called aronia, A-R-O-N-I-A, and melacarpa. And the aronia berry is also very high in nutrients, and if you take that with your vitamin C, it's extremely beneficial, especially for your blood vessels and for bruising, along with quercetin. And teenagers who think their parents are loving are less likely to be cyberbullies. That's correct. Emotional support from parents, and specifically how teens perceive their relationship with their parents, is associated with cyberbullying behaviors. So remember, you're a parent. You're there to guide your child from birth right up through until they're on their own. You're not there to be their best friend. You're not there for sleepovers. You're not there to in any way enable them. You're there to guide them. So you have to understand there's a line you should not cross, so that at least the teen, the young kid, the toddler is given an understanding of the transitions they're going through, and you can help guide them. You can't do that if you coddle them, spoil them, or give them this sense of entitlement. That works against them, not for them. This was published in the International Journal of Bullying. We are into our program, and one last thing from Cambridge University. We have an enormous amount of people, over 460 million worldwide, who have diabetes, and at least three times that. So you're up to about 1.5 billion people who are pre-diabetic. So what is the single most important indicator that you're going to end up diabetic? Body mass index is a more powerful risk factor for diabetes than genetics. And that belly is what determines. So that belly doesn't get there on its own. You put it on, you can take it off. That requires discipline, focus, self-love. But that helps prevent diabetes, because diabetes, I just counseled a good friend of mine who's diabetic. He's in a wheelchair, he's got neuropathy, some chronic pain. That isn't fun. So there's a negative consequence to that belly. Get rid of the belly. And also, American University just came up with a study, and good for them. Researchers show how a diet change can help veterans with call for illness. Study examines the impact of diet and low in glutamate, high in nutrients. And this goes back to the Persian Gulf War of 1991. And I was working with a lot of people. I mean, probably 300 to 400 Gulf vets. Some didn't even make it into the Gulf. They got their anthrax and botulism shots and at least 10 other shots that they were never told what they were before they went over, and they got sick and they got Gulf War syndrome. People that went on aircraft carriers and never made it to the Gulf, they got Gulf War syndrome. Yet Hillary Clinton and her committee, a fraud that it was, the FDA, the Defense Department, nobody wanted to take responsibility because they started calculating, what's this going to cost us if this is a chronic condition that we have to pay for? It would end up in being trillions of dollars. So they just said, it doesn't exist, it's all in your mind. And shame on them for doing that. I did 3 documentaries on this subject, something I'm very familiar with. But I was able to help every single person with Gulf War syndrome, and it starts with a plant-based healthy diet and lots of juices, especially the green juices, because the green juices were rich in chlorophyll and that chelates coming from the chelate grab claw-like. You grab a heavy toxin and you take it out of the system. So the more you juice, the more you purge toxins. So they finally caught up. Not bad, 30 years later, but at least now they're recognizing that. Good for them. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I've got a big report today, by the way, an original in-depth investigative report on the flu shot. It's supposed to protect us. We're being told it will protect us from COVID. And therefore, states are mandating it. Good for them. We should all get the flu shot to be protected against the flu, of course. But against COVID, you bet. I'm getting in line. Oh, but wait. Something's not quite right there. I'll tell you what's not quite right in a few minutes. But I want you to listen to something. I'm going to play a couple clips for you. You can watch these by going to prn.fm. And by the way, we're going to have 2 talks. One's, these are mainstream doctors being interviewed. Nothing controversial, nothing holistic in their practice. And they're talking about what happens when a doctor is not allowed to treat their patients based upon the historical doctor-patient relationship when it comes to COVID, seeking out non-toxic, effective medications that would help them, not waiting for a miracle vaccine that's not going to be a miracle. In fact, Mary Holland, who's going to appear next week on this program, stated that she expects over 1 million Americans who get the vaccine to die. And then we also have another doctor. These are both relatively short interviews where hydroxychloroquine, what is the evidence? Now, this is a mainstream, highly respected medical doctor, non-controversial, and he's got all the graphs. And what have I been saying all along? I said, when I looked at the studies, and that's all I do, I study all the time, studies, every day. I'm looking at some of these doses they're giving to end-stage patients in critical care, 4 to 9,000 milligrams. Well, but what is the actual treatment that's preventing death, that's curing people? 200 to 400 milligrams. Well, that's a huge amount. That would be like saying you need, let's say, eight ounces glass of water a day, depending upon your body size. And you try that, and it works. But what if I said you need 8,000 ounces of water a day? Well, if you try that, you would die. So we have seen it in clear view. The early results of death were from over-medication, over-treatment. The people are being saved by the thousands all across the world now. It's spreading. Low dose. And he shows you the actual charts from the medical associations. It's right there all along, and no reporter was reporting on it. And finally, I mentioned the other day, on Saturday, Robert Kennedy led a group of the Children's Health Defense Fund in Berlin, and the entire area was packed. I didn't know how many people were there. And he said the news report that 3,500 Nazis were here. And he said, no, you're not Nazis. You're people who want freedom of choice and are concerned citizens. Turns out, ready for this? 1 million people. 1 million people showed up for a peaceful protest to protest mandatory vaccines, especially with this new COVID vaccine and some other issues, including 5G. Tomorrow, a special report on 5G. I've loaded this week with special reports. In fact, so many, I've got two already ready for next week as well. So that's what we're going to hear when we come back from this spot.
To look again at hydroxychloroquine, and that's exactly what I've done. And I've found a study from Belgium that gives fairly strong evidence, in fact I would say quite strong evidence, that low dose hydroxychloroquine is an effective treatment. It is an effective treatment. And it seems to lower the death rate by about 30%. Quite profound difference. And the key seems to be that they used a much lower dose than the other studies. Now, I am going to tell you briefly about three other studies as well that showed efficacy, that showed hydroxychloroquine does seem to be an effective treatment. But then we'll think about why studies have shown that it's not, and we'll talk about the recovery trial from the Centre of Oxford-based Medicine, which showed no effect and discontinued it from the trial. And we'll talk about the World Health Organization's Solidarity trial, which did much the same thing, discontinued from the trial. And then, as time permits, we'll have a look at a study from Brazil as well, which shows no effect. But it seems the key factor that people have been getting wrong, and I'm just coming to the end of the bottom line now. Just stick with me if you want the bottom line. The key factor seems to be that these studies gave too high a dose. Now, let's clarify what we're talking about here. We're talking about the World Health Organization, and we're talking about the Oxford Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine. They didn't seem to realise you had to give the right dose. Now, this is bemusing at best. Now, is hydroxychloroquine a new drug? No, we've been using hydroxychloroquine and its predecessor, chloroquine, for decades, absolutely decades, for many conditions. So it's not a new drug. This is a drug that's known. The side effects are known. The doses are well known, and yet the World Health Organization and the Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford seem to get it wrong. What is going on here? This is bemusing. You know, there's quite a few things in this pandemic, and you just can't work out why people didn't seem to realise things or get things so wrong. Let me just give you evidence for that before I finish the bottom line, before I go into the detail, for those of you who don't have enough time for this video. Now, I've just taken this morning from the British National Formulary. Now, this is what all doctors and nurse prescribers and pharmacists in the UK use. It's absolutely standard. Hydroxychloroquine sulfate, indications and dose, right? So D-O-S-E, dose. There's nothing hidden here. This is just obvious stuff. And if we look at it, we see that the normal dose is 200 to 400 milligrams daily. Daily maximum dose to be based on ideal body weight. Okay, so there's the dose. For most adults, 200 to 400 milligrams. This is absolutely standard public domain information. And yet, both of the studies that we're going to look at, the UK study and the World Health Organization study, didn't seem to realise this. So it's all very strange. Anyway, so that's the bottom line. If you want to skip this video, fine. That's good. If you want the detail, I'm going to give you the detail on the study from Belgium that shows efficacy, first of all. Then a few other brief studies that show efficacy as well. And then I'll show you why it seems these other studies got it wrong. Now, let's start off with this study from Belgium. Now, I know I'm on pretty thin ice here, so I know this has been a controversial topic. And to be fair, I probably steered away from it more than I should.
Okay, what he is saying is this. every physician in Great Britain, in fact, every physician in the European Union, has a guideline on hydroxychloroquine. The dose is 200 to 400. Some go 200 twice a week, preventatively, prophylactically, especially those who are older and therefore or obese or have some comorbidity. But the Oxford, the other studies that did not show efficacy, they were going between 3,000 and 8,000 milligrams. And these people are all in critical care. And we know it doesn't work in critical care. Shouldn't be using critical care. You've got to get this early. And we have hundreds of doctors now in the United States alone. They're calling themselves frontline doctors. They're all being attacked, by the way, by the mainstream media. Now, mind you, none of these doctors are controversial or have had anything in their background that would, let's say, make them stand out as controversial people. These are just regular doctors, but they've had enough of the lies, the misinformation, and controlled by Anthony Fauci and the White House and Trump. So they're just telling the truth. So that's what you should know. Now, the full 38-minute interview is on PRN.fm. Now we're going to take a moment, and here's a woman. She's a minority person, and she is just a regular board-certified physician. She also teaches. She's an academic as well as a clinician. And she was attacked in Australia, and though she's, I believe, Canadian, because she was advocating hydroxychloroquine. Here is the response, just to show you that when you step out of line and you actually give your clinical and professional experience to the public, you're in violation of shut up and stay in line or we'll attack you. This is just one example.
More importantly, Dr. Kovinder Gill is an Ontario paediatrician and president and founder of Concerned Ontario Doctors. This week, Australia's shadow health minister, Chris Bowen, you know, the bloke who was responsible for the lamentable grocery watch and fuel watch back in Kevin Rudd's day, and the genius who told undecided voters at the last election, if you don't like Labor's policies, don't vote for us. Good advice, Chris. Anyway, Chris Bowen, ever up to strident form, chose to attack Dr. Gill, Canadian doctor, in our parliament this week, under parliamentary privilege, I presume, calling her a zealot and a conspiracy theorist. Why? Well, because he was attempting, and failing as usual, to censor Liberal MP Craig Kelly for the comments Craig Kelly had made in parliament the previous day.
State governments that are putting rulings in that are actually making a doctor liable to go to prison if he prescribes hydroxychloroquine to one of his patients if he thinks it may save their life.
So instead of engaging in the debate, our shadow health minister, Chris Bowen, simply decided to smear the reputations of doctors around the world and, of course, Craig Kelly. Well, here on Outsiders, we prefer to keep an open mind, unlike Mr. Bowen. And so now you can decide for yourself whether Dr. Gill is a zealot and conspiracy theorist or not. She joins us live from Toronto. Dr. Gill, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks so much for coming on. I'm glad to introduce you to Australia. I'm sorry it's in these circumstances where one of our less able and competent MPs decides to attack you. Before we get into the issues, what's it like to be attacked in Canada from an Australian parliamentarian?
It's a first-time experience. I'm actually quite shocked.
Well, you look fine on it. Now, tell us your main concern. You've spoken about hydroxychloroquine. You've spoken, more importantly, and we're going to discuss this here today, about the importance of the doctor, the sanctity of the doctor-patient relationship, and why historically it is so important. So explain this to us, Dr. Gill.
Absolutely. So following the atrocities of the World War II, where doctors had actually been forced to commit crimes against against humanity. Countries had gathered and they signed the Declaration of Geneva, and that was in 1948. And the purpose of that declaration was to then form the International Code of Medical Ethics, which demanded that physicians practice their profession with conscience. And it was to ensure the sanctity of the doctor-patient relationship from any future intrusion by government, any future violation, a coercion, or any sort of a manipulation by governments or its bureaucrats in the practice of the actual profession. And now in 2020, we see a very dangerous and unprecedented violation of that very doctor-patient relationship.
So what we're seeing, you're referring to hydroxychloroquine around the world in some countries like Australia, certain states. This drug, tell us about the drug in a second, but it has been literally criminalised in some of Australian states. Mm-hmm. Doctors could go to prison or face huge fines. Now, tell us about this drug and why you think bureaucrats involving themselves in banning this drug are violating those Geneva principles.
Well, it's crucial to understand that hydroxychloroquine is a safe and generic medication that was actually approved 65 years ago, and it is sold over the counter in the majority of the world, and it's actually on the World Health Organization's list of essential medications. And when used in the appropriate dose, there has been no reported cardiac toxicity in all of the clinical trials and studies done in COVID-19 patients to date. A study published recently in the Journal of Electrocardiology actually found no clinically significant ECG changes in the non-ICU COVID-19 patients when they were treated with a five-day azithro-hydro-combo. And there was actually a peer-reviewed systematic publication that actually showed that HCQ was protective to the heart, as opposed to being harmful. And there was no cardiac toxicity or death actually reported as a result of HCQ and the azithro combination being used in all the peer-reviewed literature for COVID-19 patients. So it's that review actually concluded that hydroxychloroquine should not be restricted for the use of COVID-19 patients. And I think it's so fundamental for the public to understand that hydroxychloroquine has its on-label uses for such things as a malaria prophylaxis or for the treatment of certain autoimmune conditions. However, doctors have always had the ability to prescribe existing approved medications for non-indicated conditions. This is known as off-label use of that medication, and it occurs when doctors utilize their clinical knowledge in discussion with their patients in that sacred doctor-patient relationship, and they get their patients' informed consent, such as treating early COVID-19 patients with the hydroxychloroquine. So it's absolutely appalling that we're seeing this unprecedented violation of the doctor-patient relationship, where we have many of the developed countries around the world that are actually prohibiting doctors and sanctioning them if it is prescribed to their patients. And such a violation, I have to stress, has never occurred before for any medication ever. This discussion has become extremely politicized. So we really need to get back to talking about the science and the logic and the facts.
That's the trouble. I've said it all along. The numbers don't add up. They're not accurate. We're being misled, and it's been politicized by both groups. And now they want to rush a vaccine through without it being properly tested. By the way, this just came from Robert Kennedy Jr. He wants an investigation on potential life-threatening anaphylaxis if injected with Moderna's COVID vaccine. Here's what he says. This is just an hour ago. Quote, on August 26th, Children's Health Defense wrote a letter to Dr. Jerry Medikoff, director of the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Human Research Protection, asking for an investigation into serious safety concerns with COVID-19 vaccine being developed by Moderna. Moderna's version of the vaccine, championed by Dr. Anthony Fauci and funded with $500 million in taxpayer dollars through Dr. Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, contains polyethylene glycol, a molecule to which approximately 72% of American population have antibodies and 8% have highly elevated antibodies. People who have pre-existing antibodies to this chemical polyethylene glycol could experience, listen carefully, life-threatening anaphylaxis if injected with the polyethylene glycol-containing substance such as Moderna's COVID vaccine. Additionally, antibodies to this can both decrease the effectiveness of the vaccine and increase the risk of side effects. So now you know even more about the dangers of Moderna's vaccine. And we already told you and showed you the examples of how many of the few people in their study ended up in the hospital and how serious it is. So just something for you all to consider. And a few more things. This is from Boston University School of Medicine. COVID has likely tripled depression rate. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Network Open. And that's one of the reasons you're seeing high levels of suicide, very high levels, in younger people who are not dying of COVID. In fact, there's now new studies showing that the children who died of COVID-19, according to Ross Clark, in this new study, shows were already seriously ill. Quote, "It has been clear from the start of the COVID-19 crisis from Wuhan experience, before cases were confirmed in Britain, that it was a disease with relatively little impact on children. A broad study led by Liverpool University and published in the British Medical Journal today confirmed that and sheds a lot more light on how COVID-19 affects children. The study looks at data from 260 hospitals in England, Scotland, and Wales, to which 69,516 patients were admitted with COVID symptoms. And of these, 651 were ages 19 and 225 were ages 12 months. Serious underlying medical conditions were present in 42% of the children. Listen carefully. No children without a serious comorbidity died. Let me repeat that. No children without a serious comorbidity died, and neither did any child between the ages of 28 days and 15 years of age. Most were successfully treated on hospital wards. And so that's just the latest. But is this being broadcast from the British Medical Journal on CNN or any Washington Post? No. And they're not going to. You're only getting part of the information. And that's unfortunate. Sadly enough, even on Pacifica, many of the people who are considered, you know, activists and, well, they may be activists, but they're also corporate democratic activists, and they're towing the line about pushing the vaccine, and that's their right, but it's unfortunate. And by the way, if you want to know the truth, why PBS and NPR and all the media seem to love Bill Gates, how about reading, as I did, the Columbia Journalism Review just out, and it details in an expose, a scathing expose, on the Bill Gates Foundation and how he and the foundation buys influence with journalists. Yes, it's a scathing report. So kudos to the Columbia Journalism Review for putting the muscle behind having Tim Schwab perform an in-depth investigation to how the Gates Foundation has lavished money on various not-for-profit news organizations like NPR, as well as other news media, and gets all good coverage, which he doesn't deserve. Now, to a special in-depth report on the flu vaccine. It is entitled, "The Flu Shot Will Protect Us from COVID? But where is the science?" Everything I'm about to say has been fully vetted and referenced with peer-reviewed literature, and it will be published on PRN today. In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, states are making efforts through their legislatures to mandate the influenza vaccine for everyone. Several days ago, Massachusetts became the first state to mandate the shot for students, and other states such as New Jersey, New York, and Vermont are in session to consider following suit. Although there is absolutely no confirmatory evidence to even suggest that the flu vaccine can prevent or protect someone from COVID-19, health officials nevertheless are eager to push forward with this ridiculous strategy. Where's the actual peer review science that is sufficiently rigorous to reach a consensual conclusion for this belief? It does not exist. I repeat, it does not exist. It is a phantom. We might be reminded of historian Daniel Boorstin's insightful realization in his book, The Discoverers. He said, "The greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance. It is the illusion of knowledge." This is the dilemma of delusional thinking that pervades the biological, medical, and cognitive sciences rather than the hard sciences of physics, chemistry, and mathematics. Whenever we are faced with proclamations from the medical establishment, and especially Bill Gates or Anthony Fauci and the World Health Organization, when they advertise propaganda about safety and efficacy of many vaccines on the market, we must pause, go to neutral, take a step back, and question their certainty. Rather than charging forward with bogus assumptions, it would seem wiser to consider several studies that indicate, rather than protecting us from potential COVID-19 infection, the flu vaccine actually increases our susceptibility to other infections, including respiratory illnesses, also including coronavirus strains. I do not say this in any form of conjecture. Sometimes our world has an unusual way of proving warnings that we didn't pay attention to and later have really terrible results. The H1N1 flu fiasco was just one example. The swine flu was another. So now we have an opportunity to either heed or disregard to our benefit or our detriment. The great physicist and Nobel laureate Niels Bohr called this synchronicity. On December 31st, 2019, in order to usher in the new year, China reported the first case of, quote, an unusual pneumonia, end quote, in its port city of Wuhan. A week later, on January 7th, the pathogen was identified as a novel strain of coronavirus. That same month, the prestigious journal Vaccine published a study conducted by the Armed Forces Health Surveillance Branch at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Researchers investigated viral interference due to receiving the flu shot. In other words, does the flu vaccine make a recipient more susceptible to other non-influenza respiratory viral infections? The study's conclusions state, quote, vaccine-derived virus interference was significantly associated with coronavirus and human metapneumovirus, end quote. However, this is not the first time that viral interference from the flu vaccine has been associated with an increase in non-influenza respiratory infections. To date, there is only one gold standard clinical trial. That's it, one in the world, with the flu vaccine that compares vaccinated versus unvaccinated. And it's not good news for considering any possible legitimacy for even recommending a flu shot during this pandemic. Then the University of Hong Kong did a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, followed the health conditions of vaccinated and unvaccinated children between the ages of 6 and 15 years of age for 272 days. The trial concluded the flu vaccine holds no health benefits, zero benefits. In fact, those vaccinated with the flu virus were observed to have a 550% higher risk of contracting non-flu virus respiratory infections. It was a dramatic number of incidences of non-influenza infections found in the flu vaccinated group. 105 cases, which included rhinovirus, Coxsackie virus, echovirus, and coronavirus, as opposed to those who received a placebo. In other words, the results show that receiving the flu shot may increase your risk of contracting another infectious virus such as COVID-19. For some odd and strange reason, underlying the efforts to mandate the flu vaccine for all students is a false belief that COVID-19 poses a far greater lethal threat than influenza. So, where's the proof? It doesn't exist. In fact, childhood mortality from seasonal flu infections is actually significantly increasing in numbers and teen deaths. So, in the latter infection rate has lasted months longer than even a severe flu season. As the CDC's latest COVID-19 statistics published on August 27th, there have been 101 reported deaths among children and teens. Oddly, back in March, Business Insider was reporting that the CDC was confirming 136 pediatric deaths, which clearly contradicts the CDC's own current statistics on its website. This is another indication of systemic incompetence and confusion that has gone viral throughout the federal agency. So far this year, of Corona and the CDC has reported 174 childhood flu deaths. For the past 15 years, childhood flu deaths were higher in 9 of those years than COVID-19. During the 2018-19 season, which was regarded as especially virulent, there were 179 deaths and 110 the year before from the flu, not COVID. The H1N1 swine flu pandemic of 2009 and 10 was the worst in several decades, with 282 young people flu deaths. Yet there was no lockdown, no school closures, or mandatory masks or social distancing in response to the swine flu. Consequently, where is the sound scientific evidence to warrant the draconian measures being taken to presumably protect students from cross-infections? It doesn't exist. We have looked for firm and convincing medical evidence to even suggest that flu vaccines are a viable means to ward off COVID-19, and we can't find it. Earlier, we reported how the CDC has recategorized influenza and pneumonia cases as COVID-19. In the same vein, how many deaths assigned to COVID virus or coronavirus may actually be caused by a flu strain? German public health expert Dr. Wolfgang Wodarg notes that it is, quote, the well-known fact that that in every flu wave, 7 to 15% of acute respiratory illnesses are coming along with coronaviruses, end quote. We still do not know COVID-19's pathogenetic role and impact compared to the common seasonal flu. Instead of blindly mandating flu vaccination, our legislators and media need to be performing their due diligence to validate the CDC and Bill Gates' rhetoric and spin about flu vaccines as a prophylactic to curb the spread of COVID-19. But even more important, they need to look at the volumes of studies indicating the flu vaccine's lack of efficacy to protect us from influenza and the vaccine's terrible safety record and adverse effects. Sitting on millions of flu shots to be administered and handicapped with a past history of flu vaccine feeble viral protection, and more Americans realizing the vaccine is either a sham or something not to be bothered with, the CDC and FDA are desperately pulling all of their stops to motivate people, scaring them and families to rush to their local Walmart, Costco, or pharmacy and get inoculated. At their best, flu vaccines remain about 50 to 60% effective, according to official health statements, but there are side effects in every single vaccine. However, the World Health Organization's predictions for the 2014-15 flu strains were a bust. The match was such a failure that the CDC was forced to warn the American public that the vaccine was only 23% effective. They lied. The 2017-18 seasonal vaccine was another bomb. Although the CDC claimed the vaccine was 40% effective, an independent study at Rice University in Houston determined it was only 19% of efficacy, and they estimated a 20% efficacy for the prior season. Well, given the frequent ineffectiveness of the seasonal flu vaccines, especially for the 65-year-old group, predictive methodologies to determine which flu strains emerge during any given influenza season have more in common with medieval divination than sound science. Another less discussed finding about the dismal flu season efficacy was determined at Kaiser Permanente, Northern California, last year. Reviewing 45,000 medical records of patients tested positive for influenza, researchers charted a trend that indicates that, quote, the risk of contracting the flu climbs about 16% for every 28 days after vaccination. Let me repeat that. When you get a vaccine for the flu, every 28 days after that, you have a 16% increased risk of adverse effects. Therefore, if the particular season's vaccine is a dud to begin with, immune protection could potentially wane within a month in some patients. In a study by Dr. Danuta Skoronsky in Canada, individuals with a history of receiving consecutive seasonal flu shots, meaning every year, over several years, had an increased risk of becoming infected with H1N1 swine flu. Skoronsky commented on his findings that, quote, policymakers have not yet had a chance to fully digest them, the study's conclusions, or understand their implications. Who knows? Frankly, the wise man knows he knows nothing when it comes to influenza, so you always have to be cautious in speculating, end quote. More importantly, according to Dr. Tom Jefferson, formerly the Cochrane Collaboration, it makes little sense to keep vaccinating against seasonal influenza based upon the evidence. Jefferson has also endorsed more cost-effective and scientifically proven means of minimizing the transmission of flu, hand-washing regularly, wearing masks. There's also substantial peer-reviewed literature supporting the supplementation of vitamin D3. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny reviewed the Cochrane database reviews on the flu vaccine's efficacy in a review of 51 separate studies involving 294,000 children. There was, quote, listen carefully, please, no evidence that injecting children 6 to 24 months of age with a flu shot was any more effective than a placebo. In children over 2 years of age, flu vaccine effectiveness was 33% of the time preventing flu. In children with asthma, inactivated flu vaccine did not prevent influenza-related hospitalizations in children. The database shows that children who received the flu vaccine were at a higher risk of hospitalization than children who did not receive the vaccine, end quote. In a separate study involving 400 children with asthma receiving a flu vaccine and 400 who were not immunized, there was no difference in the number of clinic and emergency room visits and hospitalizations between the two groups, 400 in each group. Asthma and got a vaccine, asthma did not. No difference. It was effectively non-effective. During every annual quarter, the CDC's Advisory Committee on Childhood Vaccines meets, and the Department of Justice releases its report on settlements made for vaccine injuries and deaths. In recent years, the flu vaccine has topped the charts. It bears noting that the CDC itself admits that only 10% of vaccine adverse effects are GO-reported. However, independent analysis from Harvard University indicates it may be as little as 1 to 2%, meaning 98 to 99% of people who have an adverse reaction to a vaccine never seek help. For almost a decade, the CDC has known influenza vaccines are ineffective and life-threatening for the elderly, but continues to market them without hesitation. The good news is that Americans are rapidly losing confidence in the CDC. The panic being orchestrated by the CDC's inept response to COVID-19 should convince everyone that the agency is no longer serving public interest. And finally, imagine the tens of thousands of children and families who would have been saved from lifelong neurological damage and immeasurable suffering if the CDC was not indebted to protecting the toxic products of the pharmaceutical industry and was serving the health and well-being of American children. And we can begin to further dismantle this citadel of despotic medical fascism by simply refusing the flu vaccine and protecting ourselves by adopting a healthier lifestyle during flu season. End of message. The entire article is completely documented. We are being lied to, people. We're being manipulated. All because on the other end of this are vaccine manufacturers who now seek and have received complete indemnification of any liability. So if they killed 1 million people, as Mary Holland suggested, and I'm going to ask her to substantiate her fears on an upcoming program next week, they would not have to pay a penny. The CDC makes money. It has patents. U.S. Public Health Service has patents. Anthony Fauci, scientists working there, have patents. Of course they're going to support, vaccinate, and take these expensive drugs. Oh, by the way, the fact that we sit on people's boards of directors that are making these drugs and vaccines, walk on by. There's nothing to see here. Yeah, there's a lot to see. And the mainstream media is complicit. Many people within the so-called alternative media, even progressive media, are also complicit. Either they're too illiterate to do their own homework, or they are ideologically aligned just to be sock puppets or mouthpieces for special interest groups. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.